Okay, while the projector warms up, I just want to spend a few minutes talking about the project. I mentioned the project, you know, on Monday, and I said it's essentially going to run through the whole semester and parallel what we do in class. So why, you know, don't look at the Hitachi. There's nothing you're going to learn by reading Hitachi over and over again. The slides will come on. The project is a group project. So the first thing I want you to do this week, this is your mission for the week, is to find a group. No? And that group can be anywhere from 4 to 8 people, right? So you can, you know, whatever you choose. With one caveat, you have to remember, if you pick a group of 6, you need to do 6 companies. So you're going to get no savings by doing a larger group. The group, each person in the group has to pick a company. Okay? Now, when you think about picking a company, basically, here's what this project is entirely about. It's about taking that company for a ride through this entire semester. Everything I do in class on my 6 companies, on Disney, on Vale, on Deutsche Bank, on Bookscape, you will be doing on your companies, right? Which means you have to be ready for surprises. Like what last spring, some people picked Boeing at the start of the semester, not expecting any surprises. They picked a nice, mature company. We know what it does. And of course, as you know, the 737 MAX problem kind of imploded on it. I think that makes it interesting and fun. You don't control the outcome, but for those of you control freaks, this is going to freak you out. You're going to pick a company that you think is nice and stable, and God help you. Okay? So don't go pick a company because it'll make your life easier, because God has a way of then saying, okay, you want an easy life? Let me make it difficult for you. Okay? So as you pick a company, and I'll give you some guidance, there are 43,000 publicly traded companies in the world, so don't tell me you can't think of a company, okay? I will impose some constraints for your own protection. And I'll tell you up front that some of you will ignore my constraints and pick a company and come crying in week 6, and I will try not to tell you I told you so. But I would probably say I told you so, and you can still change your company. Okay? So here are my constraints. First, within each group, there has to be a common theme. Common theme doesn't mean all 6 companies have to be in the same sector. I'll give you an example. Your theme can be travel. So tell me some companies in the travel business. You can have airlines, you can have a startup, you can have Travelocity, you can have... You know, you can basically come up with 6 companies, and it's a wide area. And I'm going to define theme very broadly. For instance, I think every year somebody picks vice as their theme. Vice, okay? And you know what's in there, right? Gambling stocks, tobacco stocks, casino stocks. You can throw cannabis stocks in there. Hey, if that's what you feel is going to make your group click, that's fine as well. You will learn as much by looking at vice companies as you will by looking at really good ESG companies. So the theme is only to keep you guys on the same page. Okay, so don't take the theme too literally and say, I need 6 deal companies. One thing I would suggest is go for diversity across companies. Don't make them all 6 big utilities. You will find they all do the same thing. Not because they're all doing the right thing, but because they do what everybody else does. Okay? So try to get small companies and large companies. Try to pick domestic companies and foreign companies. Okay? And here are my constraints. Try to avoid financial service companies. Not because they're difficult, but they're extraordinarily boring companies. And here's what. It said corporate finance about making the investment decision, the financing, and the dividend decision, right? What's the problem with the financial service company? Your financial decision is constrained by regulatory capital requirements. So you can sit there and say, I'd like to double debt and have... No, it's not in your control. So avoid banks and insurance companies, because not only are they boring, but you'll get mired in regulatory capital requirements. It's not worth the effort. Second, avoid money-losing companies. I might be repeating myself. I mean, financial service companies, money-losing companies, they might be the same thing in some markets. Avoid money-losing companies, again, for the same reasons. And here's why. You pick a big money-losing company. And I said, how much debt should you have? What's the answer? Come on, let's do the project. So after you've done the investment analysis and come up with a hurdle rate, say, how much debt should you have? From the perspective of the fact that they're already losing money, they can't borrow money. So if they borrow money, they're doing it because they're either desperate or because they want to give up control. So with money-losing companies, the financing and the dividend decision are already done for you. You're not going to learn anything interesting after the seventh week because what do I do now? Avoid companies with large capital arms. I was going to say GE. GE is already a disaster. I would avoid GE in the first place. But the problem with doing companies with big capital arms, GE Capital, GMAC, is you have a bank embedded in a company. So you want to avoid them for the same reasons they avoid banks, because you now have a financial service company embedded. If it's a small part of your company, it's okay. Okay? So you might be able to get away doing, you know, a smaller company with a small financing arm, but if it's 40, 50, 60% of the company, avoid those. And finally, avoid REITs. Real estate investment trusts were created in the U.S. from a law in 1971. And you know what the problem with REITs is? They're incredibly constrained entities. And here's why. If you're a REIT, what's the only thing you're allowed to invest in? Real estate. You can't go out of that business. So when you get to the investment decision, say real estate is going slow, I would like to technology. It doesn't work with a REIT. You can't wander off the reservation. In terms of dividend policy, what are REITs required to do? They're required to return 90% of their earnings as dividends by law. So you don't have any freedom. And here's the final catch. In return for having to pay that much in dividends, REITs don't have to pay taxes. So when you get to the financing decision, it'll turn out debt doesn't make any sense to you. So REITs are almost preordained to end up at a place. It might not be a good place, might not be a bad place, but you really don't get a chance to check out choices you could make. So those are the only constraints. Other than that, everything else you can pick. And you think that takes a lot of companies. You have about 35,000 companies still left. I went through and screened on Capital IQ. You have 35,000. You will have no trouble finding a company. In fact, if any of you wants to do a private company, I have no problem with you doing a private company. As long as you get along, it has to be a family company probably because you have access to the financials or a really good friend. Here's what you have to factor in. By the end of the semester, your family might have disowned you and your really good friend might not be a friend. So as long as you can deal with those side costs, I don't have a problem with you doing private companies. As I said, the objective of this project is not for you to do check boxes. In fact, I've already built a spreadsheet that will do all the number crunching on the project for you. I'm going to hold it back from you and give it in pieces. So I could give you the spreadsheet, you could enter the numbers, all of the numbers for the project will be churned out. This is not about whether you can compute the cost of capital for your company. The mechanics of doing that are absolutely trivial. You get there, it's how you use the cost of capital. This is about building a narrative for your company that by the end of the semester, I come to you and say, hey, what do you think about the company? And I'm the CEO. You sit across the table and you tell me what my company does well, what it does badly, and what it could do differently. That's what the numbers are for, is for you to build that narrative. Now, if you go to the web page for the class, you'll actually see examples of past projects. And you'll see they're all over the place. Some do it in PowerPoint, you know, the whole thing in PowerPoint slides. Others do it in Word. I have absolutely no formatting structure, which is a bad thing for some of you because you'd prefer that I give you a very, very rigid format. This, I'm going to let you tell the story for your company in a way that you think is most effective. But don't get mired in showing me the mechanics. Trust me, I know how to compute the cost of capital. So you don't have to tell me this is how you compute the cost of capital. Dispense with the mechanics, and there's going to be a page limit. You know why? All of the projects come in on May 11th. In this class, I will get about 80 projects. In the valuation class, I'll get another 80 projects. In the undergraduate valuation class, I'll get another 80 projects. I have 7 days to grade them, get the scores recorded, get the grades out. You can work out 240 times however many pages I'll be reading. I am a speed reader, but not that speedy a reader. So if you turn in 100-page reports, after page 20, I would stop reading. So the constraint is going to be 20 pages for the entire group report, which means you have to think about ways to present your findings as a group. You know what I mean by that? If you write 5 separate reports and bind them together on May 10th, not only will you lose the essence of the project, but you're going to have a really tough time meeting page requirements. So this project will require that you don't have to get together as a group every week, but that at least you talk to each other as you go along. And for those people who are lagging, that you try to get them on board so that you can do the project. My advice is do it in parts as you go through. And one of the things you're going to face again is the numbers keep shifting on you. Not because you have some eye problem, but you know why the numbers will keep shifting on you, right? So your companies are going to report earnings next month. So what you reported as revenues will be different. So pick, you know, obviously, I can't expect everybody to update the numbers as of May 11th because the interest rates are going to change, the risk premiums are going to change, but try to kind of get a point in time and say, look, this is the point in time, we've got the financials, let's do the project. And I will be okay with the fact that there might be a 6-week lag between the time you did it. In fact, I'll tell you, most of you probably will get the project numbers starting to go in the last week, so everything is updated, which is the good news. The bad news is that last week is nightmarish for you and nightmarish for me. Because when you run into a problem in week 15 and say, what do I do? I can't make a suggestion I could have made in week 6, which is try a different company. Because I might, at some point, if you're running into issues with a company that you feel are insurmountable for you, rather than give you 5 different things you can do, I might say, you know what, maybe your life will be easier if you tried something else. So that's the advantage of getting started and moving. You know, I won't go through the rest of the packet, but here's what you're going to see with the rest of the packet. You're going to see 10 parts to the project. Essentially, they're parallel to the class. And with each part, what you will see is the kinds of questions I would like you to answer in that section. Please don't turn in a project report with a question, answer, question, answer, because that's not going to be a great formatting device. This is more to guide you on what exactly am I looking at in each section. So in the corporate governance section, I'm asking, where does the power lie in your company? Does it lie with stockholders? Does it lie with managers? Does it lie with the government? How does that play out in decision-making? Below it, I also tell you that part of the project, whether it's going to be primarily quantitative or qualitative. So when you're doing that analysis, I can't find any numbers. The corporate governance section, that's exactly what I expect you to run into. There will be fewer numbers, more fuzzy stuff. And then I also list out spreadsheets that might be useful for that part of the project that you can find on my website. Again, I don't want you to reinvent the wheel and be building spreadsheets for the rest of the semester. And data sets that I have that you might want to draw on. So, for instance, I have a data set which tells you what CEO pay is by sector. So you can see what your... Because much of this project is about comparing what your company does to what the rest of the business is doing. And I have data sets that will help you at least get that average so you're not doing that from scratch again. So if you get a chance, browse through it. At the moment, it's going to look intimidating. And you're going to say, I don't think I can pull this off, some of you at least. Trust me, you will pull this off, and I will drag you across the finish line if I have to. Or your group will drag you across. I mean, for 34 years, it's always worked out at the end. It's easier for me than for you because I don't have to deal with a group. You do, and I don't have to deal with the fact that this is the last weekend, you have multiple exams to get ready to. So I will nag you all through the semester, and I will do it, I was going to say, with your best interests at heart. Really not. I will nag you because I like nagging people. Okay? But if you can keep up with the project in real time, week by week, your life will get easier. And you might say, look, I have to prepare for the quiz. You know what? The best preparation you have for quizzes and exams is actually working on the project. Because it forces you to think about what we did in class and applying it with real numbers in a real company. Any questions about the project? Okay. And again, if you cannot find a group, the orphan list is open and running. Just go add your name to the orphan list, check out the other orphans, email another orphan and say, hey, I'm an orphan, you're an orphan, would you like to create an orphan group? Now, I strongly encourage you to get into a group as soon as possible rather than hang loose for the next 5 weeks and week 5 come and tell me I'm not in a group. Okay. So let's turn to the actual, like, Anybody check the bookstore? Is the packet available for sale? Do you know?
It's not there.
It's not. No. Obviously, they don't want the money either. No. Don't worry about it. The PDF versions are at least printed. Even if you plan to buy the packet, at least print off and you get a chance the first 20 pages or so, which is what we'll do today. So let's start with the objective in corporate finance. What exactly are we trying to do when we run a business? You're saying, why do we need to talk about the objective? You don't know where you're going. It doesn't matter how you get there. So in a sense, if you don't set an end game, nothing else matters. So we're going to talk about the objective in corporate finance. And in the first session, I told you what the classical objective is. You want to maximize the value of the business you run. So let's step back and think about that objective a little bit. Let's take a publicly traded company. And I'll talk about the difference with a private business. If you're a publicly traded company, think of all the players in the game. You have stockholders who own the shares in the company, and through the annual meeting and the board of directors, in theory, decide who runs the company, right? So stockholders and managers. You have bondholders and banks who lend money to the company. You have employees who work for the company. You have customers who buy products and services from the company. You have competitors who are trying to get market away from you. And finally, you have society standing on the outside, but still facing side costs and side benefits from you as a company. What kind of side costs? Some of the side costs might be the cost we think of as terrible. You know, environmental, you create a huge environmental pollution. That's a social cost. But it could be smaller side costs. You create traffic jams around your headquarters. That's a side cost. So this notion that good companies don't create side costs and bad, every business creates side costs. That hot dog stand outside creates a side cost. Every morning when I walk down that sidewalk, I have to go three steps to the right, walk around the line. You think that is so petty. 10 extra steps for me. Think of how many people walk down that sidewalk. Somebody might trip because they have to take the 10 extra steps. That is a social cost. So there are lots of different stakeholders. Let's throw that word on the table in a company. But not all of them are created equal. Let's take lenders and bankers. When they lend money to a firm, when they lend and the loan goes out, do they just give the money to you and say, do whatever you want with it? Generally, if you take a loan, there are covenants and restrictions, and they charge an interest rate. Why? Because you're taking their money, and that interest rate covers your default risk and how much they don't trust you. Right? If they don't trust you, they're going to raise the interest rate, saying you could do something terrible. So bankers have covenants, agreements, and bondholders have covenants and agreements with the firm. There's a place this is going. Okay? If you have employees, they don't work for your firm for nothing. Their wages, if they're on the factory floor, and managers have compensation contracts, which they negotiate. If it's people on the factory floor, they might negotiate through union, but basically they're trying to get the best possible wages and benefits. And we can talk about how weak unions have become and how those contracts have changed, but there is a contractual agreement again between employees and the firm. You're saying, what about customers? Hey, this is a quid pro quo, right? I buy your product, you get my money. You can't force me to buy your product. I can choose not to buy it. So customers have a kind of implicit contract. When I buy products or services from you, the contract is I pay you the money, you provide the product or service, and if I don't like it, I can complain, I can return it, or if I like it, I can come back and buy more from you. We'll come back to society because that's going to be a little fuzzy. What about your competitors? Obviously, they don't have an agreement with you because that would be illegal. This is a competition. They want to take away your market share. You want to take away their market share. This is one of those stakeholders you shouldn't be taking care of. Asking a company to take care of its competitors, it's so contrary to both human nature and what competition is about that it boggles the mind. But you know what? I've heard people do this in the last few months. That Amazon should take care of UPS and FedEx. Really? In what universe is this even making sense? We can talk about what's fair or not in terms of competition. But there the marketplace decides who the winners or losers are, and you can argue whether it's tilted in one company's direction or not. And society has an implicit contract with companies as well, which is, you know, there are regulations and laws you pass on what companies can or cannot do. And you collect a portion of the income in taxes so that you can do it. Do you see where I'm going? Every interest group here has a contractual agreement with the company. What's the only interest group that has no contract holding it together? The stockholders essentially get the residual claim. They get whatever's left over. So when you sit down to look at a company, the question you're asking is, whose interest should be served? Your first response is, everybody should be taken care of. And the problem with that is, I remember when my kids were younger and we used to go on a family vacation. What if at the start of the vacation, my wife and I got together and said, you know what, we should maximize the happiness. Everybody, we should maximize the happiness of all six of us. You know what would happen? None of us would be happy. You cannot run a business or any entity, forget about a business, with multiple objectives. You can have a single objective and multiple constraints, but you cannot have multiple objectives. Think about the process of having multiple objectives. What if I say I want to maximize value and maximize wages and maximize customer satisfaction? Absurd objective if you think about it. But what if I say that? Think about the next product you introduce. You have to price the product, right? If you want to maximize customer satisfaction, what should you price it at? Zero. Customers will be really happy for a while until you go bankrupt. And if you want to maximize wages, you might say, look, I want to set the price at a level where I can pay $20 an hour, but then nobody can afford your product. You can maximize. You see what I'm saying? You have to pick an interest group that you want to focus on as your central interest group. Doesn't mean you don't care about the rest, but they then become constraints on the process. You say, I want to maximize value subject to the constraint that I pay a decent living wage to my employees, subject to the constraint that I do the best I can to create as little cost as I can for society or create benefits for society, subject to the constraint that I don't rip off my bondholders. You have to decide what your objective is and what the constraints are. So I'll give away the game in corporate finance. In corporate finance, we've chosen. We've said our objective is to maximize the value of the business. But in practice, that objective gets narrowed, and let's see why. So let's say you're a manager of a publicly traded company. You read my corporate finance book. It says maximize the value of the business. When you're talking about maximizing the value of the business, remember that financial balance sheet we talked about yesterday? It's talking about maximizing the value of the assets in place and growth assets. You're saying you have to bring the growth assets in. Can you imagine being the manager of Casper and saying, I want to maximize the value of investments we've already made? What investments have you already made? So when you talk about maximizing the value of the business, I'm saying your job is to maximize the value of the assets side of the balance sheet. But here's the problem. How do I judge whether you're doing a good job or not? Because that's almost unobservable, right? I don't have access to your projects. You can tell me I'm taking only good projects, but that's only your word. So here's what happens in practice. Instead of maximizing the value of the business, what people say is, look, I don't, you know, lenders can take care of themselves. They protect themselves. They charge an interest rate. They have covenants. They don't need my protection. I'm going to maximize stockholder wealth. See why people narrow it down? Because U.S. managers work for the stockholders. They say, lenders take care of themselves. No, I'll negotiate the best terms I can on those bank loans, but I'm going to focus on the people who hire and fire me. I maximize stockholder wealth. And here's the second problem you run into. If you decide that's your objective, somebody has to measure stockholder wealth every year. So if you tell me that you did a good job, I have to hire McKinsey to come and say, hey, what happened to stockholder wealth last year? And they give me some model and say the value went up or the value went down. And I have no idea what they're talking about. They have no idea what they're talking about. So I cheat. And here's how I cheat. If your stock is publicly traded, every moment of every day, there is a measure of what the market thinks about your wealth. We can talk about are they efficient or not. Let's hold off on that discussion. But you have an observable number there. So rather than maximizing stockholder wealth, people say, well, just maximize stock prices. So when you see people say the objective in corporate finance is to maximize stock prices, that's really not true. It's to maximize firm value, but in practice, because it's easier to work with and more observable, it becomes maximizing stock prices. So if you open up most corporate finance textbooks, it said the objective in corporate finance is to maximize stock prices, and this has now become the straw man that people use. This is what's wrong with corporate finance. It's all about stock prices. So let's take that straw man for a ride. Let's make this the most extreme scenario you can. Could you maximize stock? So when you think about why we focus on stockholders, it's very clear. It's a one group that doesn't have a contractual claim. It's a residual claim. Therefore, since they can't, you have to give them that power to say, look, I'll take care of your interest because that's all they have. And it does give you some very neat ways of evaluating decisions. You announce an acquisition. And I want to know, was that a good deal? Instantaneously, I get a picture of whether it was a good deal, right? By looking at what? Company A buys company or announces it's going to buy company B. The announcement has happened. What happens to company A's stock price gives me at least, we can talk about do markets know what they're doing. We'll come back and evaluate that. But at that moment, I don't have to talk to experts. I can say the stock price dropped by 5%. No matter what you tell me about this deal, the market does not like it. So you can see why stock prices have become this favorite objective. It's observable, it's measurable. You can make these decision analyses in a second. But it does expose us to this critique of, hey, if you maximize stock prices, couldn't you rip off every other group? Couldn't it come at the expense of society, of customers, of employees? And the answer is absolutely. So let's take the limiting case. I call this cutthroat corporatism. Late 1800s, Andrew Carnegie and Rockefeller built these companies that were, you know, monstrosities. And here's what they did. They maximized stock price. In this case, since Rockefeller and Carnegie owned most of the stock, they were maximizing their own equity value. And they did it at the expense of the other players. So if you're a bank, you lend me money, you might set interest rates and covenants, but I look for loopholes. I rip you off. Legally, if your employees, because you don't have much negotiating power, I push your wages down and essentially say, take $3 an hour or leave. If your customers, I charge you the highest possible price and say, where are you going to go? You say, what about the competitors? Well, I find ways to use my market power to drive my competitors out and make myself a monopoly. And what about society? I really don't care about society. I create the costs and the benefits. I essentially walk the line of this is legal, this is not. And if it's not illegal, then I can do whatever I want on that, you know, on the legal side of the equation. Sometimes we might even break the law and find ways to make it legal in hindsight. We'll leave it at that. This is every corporate finance person's nightmare, because if this is what happens to companies, you're absolutely right. Maximizing stock prices is a terrible objective because the rest of the world pays a penalty for you going out and raising your stock price. So here's what I'm going to do. I am going to first get rid of some false choices we're offered. I'm going to start off with what I call the utopian world of corporate finance, the version of the world that allows us to say it's okay to maximize stock prices. Then I'm going to rip apart that utopian world and make it more real. And then we have to talk about where do we end up after we've looked at the real world, what is the best objective to pick? So let's start with some false choices. I'm often told of you, do you want to maximize stock prices or do you want to take care of your employees? Why is that the choice? Let me ask you a question. Right now, would you rather be working at Tesla or would you rather be working at Ford? I'd be working at Tesla every single time. You're saying, but it's such, bad company. It's such a year. Let's face it. When your market price is going up and you're working at a company, it feels really good because some of your compensation is tied to the stock price, right? You got pension funds that are often investment stock. Bad idea, but it's investment stock. You might have options, but it's not just the fact that your compensation is tied. It just feels much better to walk into a company where the stock price has gone 80%. If any of you worked at companies where the stock price kept dropping and dropping, after a while, it feels like a funeral home. Okay? You walk in, everybody's leaving already at 9 a.m. People are checking out, you know, job sites while they're sitting at the desk. Well, I don't know whether I'll have a job anymore. Here's a very simple test. Take companies, take the change in market price, take the change in employee wages. And you know what you find across all companies? A positive correlation or a negative correlation? You find a positive correlation. I can give you anecdotal evidence, obviously, of companies that increase their stock price by cutting wages. And when that happens, you see a headline. New York Times lays off so-and-so, stock price jumped 3%. You make the connection. If you lay off employees, your stock price... But this is not the way we decide how... We look at the overall picture, and I guarantee you, and I'll see if I can find some studies on this, that if you look at companies whose stock prices have gone up and employee wages, that there is a positive correlation between the two, not a negative one. So this is a false choice. Would I like to take care of my employees and maximize stock price? Yes. Sometimes there will be you'll be forced to make trade-offs. And of course, then you have to decide whose interests come first. Second, you'll be told that maximizing stock prices is incompatible with customer satisfaction. And as I said, customer satisfaction is a stupid objective function. Maximizing customer satisfaction is absurd. And here's why. Let's say you run the limited. So your limited store is still around. It might be bankrupt by now. Every brick and mortar retail firm. And a marketing guru. In fact, I had the misfortune in the early 90s of actually doing one of those management presentations to the Gap top management. At that time, the Gap was one of the fastest growing retail firms around. And my misfortune was I followed the marketing guru up to the podium. And he got up and said, the objective at the Gap should be to maximize customer satisfaction. And I got up, and at the risk of being thrown out, I said, that is the stupidest objective I've ever heard. Because if you take that to its logical limit, here's what you should do next. Remove those cash registers in every Gap store. Let people walk in, pick up the khakis, walk out. They will be incredibly satisfied. But you'll go bankrupt. As a company, do you care about customers being satisfied? Yes, why? Because you want them to. You're saying that is so mercantile. You are a business. This is a mercantile transaction. You want to hide behind fuzzy things, that's fine. You're an Etsy kind of company. Okay. But I bought from Etsy. They took my money. They won't take it back even though I got the wrong item. I feel really pissed off. I am not satisfied. So I don't care what their annual reports say or that they're a benefit corporation. This is a commercial transaction. Again, think about it. Think about the companies that have high market values and think about customer satisfaction. I'll wager again that you don't increase market value by leaving your customers in the dust. There's a reason Amazon is a trillion-dollar company. How many of you are Prime members? Come on, with 110 million, it must be most of you. Would you give up your Prime membership? There is no way on God's good earth that I'm giving up my Prime membership. I know it's screwing up how I buy things. I find myself buying Prime items over non-Prime items and paying a little bit more because I know it makes my life so much easier. I live in San Diego. I can go drop off whatever I don't like in a box and it's back and I get the credit instantaneously. Amazon is a trillion-dollar company because it has satisfied customers. Bed Bath & Beyond is going to be a zero-value company sooner or later because you walk into a Bed Bath & Beyond, it's like walking into a warehouse. It's chaos, things coming at you from every direction. Forget about asking somebody for help. Nobody who works there actually knows where anything is. There's a reason when you look at brick-and-mortar retail, that brick-and-mortar retail has collapsed. I heard Macy's is closing stores and laying off people. I didn't even know that people worked at Macy's, to be quite honest. I walk in, I couldn't find cash registers that were open, employees. So when you think about, do you want to have satisfied customers, or do you, again, don't give me this false choice. Will there be cases where I have to make that trade-off, where I have to charge customers a higher price because I want to do better? Absolutely. Netflix will probably have to raise what they charge for a monthly subscription, given how much they spend on content. Is it going to make you a little less happy at Netflix? Yes. Would you like them to charge you nothing? Yes. But they cannot continue as a business. And finally, of course, anytime you tell people you're in corporate finance, there are people who say, you're destined for hell. You're a sinner. You've broken the moral code. My youngest son is still in college, so he has a very strong moral code. Because he doesn't have to make choices yet. So he can say things like, these companies are terrible. You can't work for a company. I say, go work for a nonprofit. It's fine. But don't expect to make $250,000 a year, which is also what he wants to make. He doesn't realize these are incompatible objectives. No, he's got to figure that out. But again, you're told, do you want to maximize your stock prices or do you want to take care of societal interests? Again, that seems like a false choice. In 2001, Microsoft gave free computers to every public library in the country. They had hidden agendas, which is to get people to use that rotten operating system called Windows instead of a Mac. So, you put that to the system. But that's a very generous thing to do, right? Hundreds of millions of dollars. Why were they able to do it? Because they were making billions in profits. Do you think GM can afford to be charitable? With what? I still remember when my oldest son, all my kids grew up as Catholics. I'm not, but I've gone to church every Sunday for the last 34 years. I know when to stand up, when to sit down. I know all the... Yeah? But my kids have to go through the rituals. This was confirmation. And so the confirmation day, I didn't realize this was a big event. There's a party and people show up. And I didn't realize people actually give money sometimes. My oldest son, to give you some background, is, at least when he was growing up, the most stingy person on the face of the earth. He's the kind of person who the notion of sharing was not even in his lexicon. So if he had a sandwich and he took two bites and he didn't like it, if his younger brother wanted it, his response is throw it in the trash, he shouldn't have it. So I'm setting up that background, not because he's a bad person, but he was a bad kid. Right? At the end of was it first communion, I think? When what do you do when you're 8 or 9, whatever it is, first? Yeah, he at the end of the party, he collects his cash. And he has about $300 in gifts that have come in. We had some very generous neighbors. And he says, he hands me $100, and go give it to the poor, as if I have some conduit directly to the poor. Okay? And I said, Ryan, that's very generous of you. I said, why are you giving away this money? He said, I feel rich. And in a sense, that cuts to the heart of when companies feel charitable, right? When you feel rich, when your stockholders are doing well, you can afford to do things like, I'll give $1 billion to society. I'll pay $15 as a minimum wage, which is what Amazon announced. Can you imagine Walmart saying, well, we're going to pay $15 minimum wage to everybody who works in Walmart at $25. You couldn't make it because you're fighting tooth and nail just to hang in there. My point again is not that, every company that maximizes stock price is doing the right thing, but don't give me this false choice of, do you want to take care of society? Do you want to run a healthy business and make money? You can't. Those two are not mutually exclusive. In fact, I would argue that the only way for companies to be socially responsible is for them to have the buffer of making money and creating value and having happy stockholders. Because after all, no CEO has money to dole out for the company. It's stockholder wealth, right? So when you're generous with my money, remember that, that's my money as a stockholder, the only way I'm saying okay is if I feel happy with what you've been doing for me. I will wager that any of the top 20 companies in terms of market cap today could go in front of stockholders and offer to do things that cost hundreds of millions and essentially get away with it because their stockholders will give them that permission. You take the 20 companies that have done the worst over the last, take the S&P 500, take the bottom 20 companies, I'll wager those companies will have tough time getting an okay to give $5 to the homeless guy who hangs out outside the front gate. He said, no, $5, give it to me. I haven't had dividends in 10 years. False choices are what people put you in saying, do you want to do this or this? No, don't give me those choices. Let's talk about a balanced discussion. And here's where I'm going to start with. I'm going to start with what I call the utopian world from which corporate finance is born that allows us to say, hey, just go out and maximize stock price. The very fact that I use the word utopian tells you something about the assumptions I'm going to list, right? So where was utopia? In some book somewhere, it never existed. So I'm already telling you up front that the assumptions I'm going to list are patently unrealistic, but I'm going to list them anyway, and then we'll, as I said, we'll shred them. So I'm going to list the assumptions I'm going to make in terms of linkages. Stockholders and managers, managers and lenders, managers in financial markets, and managers in society. Here's what we assume in this utopian world. We assume in this world that stockholders have absolute power over managers. Don't laugh too quickly. Stockholders have absolute power. I have no power in Alibaba. You're absolutely right. But in the utopian world, there would be no Alibabas. We'll talk about what about Alibaba makes it so difficult for you to throw your weight around as a stockholder. In this world, stockholders have absolute power. They exercise it in two ways. One is through the annual meeting where they get up and vote and decide what the company should do. And the other is through the board of directors. People sometimes forget this. But in theory, you know why public companies were required to create boards of directors? It's not to soothe management egos. It's not for PR. Their original role was, since stockholders don't run the firm, they've hired managers. The board of directors' job is to actually oversee managers to make sure stockholder interests are being served. In fact, that's the way Delaware courts still define the objective. They're not true to that when they do the cases and they rule on the cases, but that was the original pick. And in the utopian world, both those mechanisms are so powerful that managers go out and do the right thing, which is they take decisions that increase value, they reject decisions that lower value, and they run the company in the best interest of stockholders. Let's take the second linkage. In the second linkage, bankers and bondholders lend money to the firm. They leave loopholes the size of a Mack truck, but the firm doesn't take advantage of them. And I'll give you the defense of it. If you're a company and you borrow money, is this the last time you're going to borrow money? Assuming you're a going concern, you've got to go back and borrow money. So we use an argument that there's a reputation effect. You have to worry about coming back to the market, and therefore you don't take advantage of lenders. Third, let's talk about financial markets. In the world, the utopian world, here's what happens. Firms reveal information about themselves honestly and on time. Remember I said, we're in utopia. I can assume whatever I want. So here's how it works. If something bad happens to you as a company, you run out of the money and say, hey guys, want to let you know right away. Terrible things are happening. The autopilot on our Teslas has gone crazy. People are running into walls. I remember when Apple first introduced Apple Maps and was doing terrible things. Like there were stories of this woman who got in, put in Apple Maps to go to Dunkin' Donuts and drove 2,200 miles. Because there's a Dunkin' Donuts in another state, you know. How you'd be stupid enough to track 2,200 miles and say, where's the Dunkin' Donuts? Where's the Dunkin' Donuts? Sometimes you have to say, these people deserve the maps they get, right? And Apple, in fact, you know, I've been an Apple user, you know, since 81. And I remember it took a long time for Apple to come out with a laptop. I think it came out in like 90 or 91. It was called the PowerBook. It was only loosely a laptop. It weighed like 20 pounds and like, you know, you had to lug it around like a machine. And it had a small problem, which is sometimes it caught fire. Turned out that the batteries they were using would overheat. And so in the world that I've described, this is not exactly a feature you go looking for in a laptop, right? Spontaneous combustion, not on that one, not on, oh, that one's got it. But in the world that I've described, here's what Apple would do. They'd go out to markets and say, what? Our laptops are hot. That's actually should give you a little indication as to how companies lie. They don't. Technically, that's the truth, right? It's hot. When you say hot, what do you think? Oh, they're selling a lot. You don't think hot as in going up in flames. So let me reframe it. In the world that I described, Apple could say, our laptops are going up in flames. We just want to let you know right away so you can react. And the markets in this utopian world are not just efficient. You know what a trading room would look like in this utopian world? It'd be full of polite intellectuals. Is that a pretty close description of a trading room? I'm sure you worked in trading rooms, polite intellectuals. So when I reveal information, what do the polite intellectuals do? They get around a table and they have an extended discussion on the long-term consequences of flaming laptops. They build in the cash flows and then they say buy, sell, whatever they have to. Hey, utopia, I can do whatever I want. And finally, in this world, there are no social costs. Why? Because every cost you create for society can be traced and charged back to you. You create environmental costs, somebody measures the global warming you're creating, charge you $1 billion. So if you're an airline and I take these transatlantic flights, they come back to you and say that created this much, you know, and maybe I'll put Greta Thunberg on top of assessing exactly how much cost, so you'd have to take a yacht or something else instead. But every cost can be traced and charged to you. You see what I've just done? I've done what economists do when there's a problem. I've assumed away the problem. You know the old saying about, put an economist on an island and he's hungry. You know what he does? He assumes he has food. Of course, the assumed food can never be eaten. You're going to die anyway, but at least you feel full while you die because the assumed food filled you up. I've, in a sense, assumed away the problem. I've made the world safe for maximizing stock prices. Because in this world, what's the only way to maximize stock prices? To do it the old-fashioned way, produce products and services that people actually need and make a profit on them. You can't increase your stock prices by ripping somebody else off. And in the utopian world, here's what that picture I showed you of the different claim holders looks like. The banks and bondholders feel okay because you're not ripping them off. You're not taking advantage of the loopholes. Employees get paid fair wages because that's already built into the process. Customers get a product or service for a price that you negotiate. They might prefer a lower price, but it's a price where you make a profit and they get a good product in return. You live in a world where there's competition, so you can't drive competition out using unfair tactics, so that's not an issue. And finally, because there are no societal costs, I'm not making my stock price higher by ripping off my bondholders, ripping off my employees. But the only reason for that is I've assumed away every conceivable way you could do it. And many people who defend old-time corporate finance often say, we're in the utopian world. But let's face it, none of us is in the utopian world. So let's talk about what can go wrong. In fact, the way to phrase this is not what can go wrong, but what cannot go wrong, because pretty much everything that can go wrong with these assumptions will. Let's start with the first linkage. I assume that stockholders have complete control over managers in the utopian world, right? Board of Directors, annual meetings. I'm going to take both those mechanisms and point out why neither mechanism is very effective in keeping managers in line. Second, I assume lenders lend money to the firm. They don't protect themselves. They don't get ripped off. In the real world, you don't protect yourself. You are asking to be ripped off, even if you're lending to a big company, a reputable company, a company that's been around a long time. In the real world, companies do hold back information. They sometimes shade the truth. They sometimes outright lie. And markets are not exactly rational and cool and efficient about the way they assess information. And finally, in the real world, companies do create social costs. They sometimes create social benefits. And the reason we can't bring them in is, A, they're fuzzy. You can't put a number on it. And B, they're subjective. The number you put on it and the number somebody else puts on it can be very different. In this world, maximizing stock prices can be deadly, right? Because you could maximize stock prices by doing some very perverse things. Like what? Creating huge social costs. Taking advantage of your customers. Paying your employees below fair wages. You're getting very closer and closer to that cutthroat corporatism world. So let's take each of these linkages and talk a little bit about why the utopian world breaks down. As I said, in the utopian world, stockholders vote at annual meetings. They decide what the company should do. The board of directors does its job. It makes sure the managers don't wander off the reservation. But in practice, neither of those mechanisms is particularly powerful at holding managers in line. Let's start with the annual meeting. We'll start with a question, and this might cut a little close to home if you have too many student loans still. And how many of you own stock in company? You own stock, you need savings, you have savings. Let's not go down that road. But how many of you are shareholders in companies? Okay, that's good. Maybe we should charge you more tuition. How many of you have gone to an annual meeting? That's not bad. Two people, three people. I own shares in about 53 companies. And you're going to find out most of them as we go through this class. I have never been to an annual meeting. I've never been tempted to go to an annual meeting. I own shares in Coca-Cola. Why? Because I like sugar. I'm morally bankrupt. You know what it means to go to the annual meeting, right? I've got to book a trip to Atlanta. And that's a ripoff. New York to Atlanta, somebody's controlling the prices. It costs like $600 round trip. I've got to end up in a hotel in that Peachtree district, which is really a district which people seem to just flee after work ends at 6 o'clock. It's like this empty place with lots of hotels. It cost me another $400 for 2 days. I spend $1,000 on an annual meeting. There goes my profit for the year. I don't have enough shares to go around to annual meetings. So for most individual investors, the reason we don't go to annual meetings is it doesn't make sense. So what do I get? I still get a chance to be at the annual meeting without being there. Like, it's almost magical. We've always had that chance. In the old days, what was that process by which stockholders could vote at annual meetings without being there? A proxy. But 6 weeks before the meeting, you used to get this big fat envelope from Coca-Cola saying, "Welcome, Coca-Cola stockholder. We care a lot about you. And here are the proxies so you can vote at what's coming up at the meeting." When I got that envelope, it was ending up in one of two places. If I was feeling socially conscious, it ended up in recycling. If not, it ended up in the trash. I wasn't in the least bit tempted to open it up and vote on a series of things. You know, people I'd never heard of for the directors. And they gave me a choice. This guy or this guy or this person, this woman. It was unusual then, you know. I just throw it in the trash. And I'm not alone. You know that about 55 to 60% of the proxies that get sent out by companies never get returned. You say, what's the big deal? 40% is still a good number. What happens to the votes on those proxies when I throw it in the trash or the recycling? Let me reframe that question. In a fair world, what should happen to those votes since I chose not to vote? You shouldn't count them, right? It's like a person who doesn't show up at an election. You can't say, well, if you don't show up, you voted for the incumbent. No incumbent in U.S. political history would ever get defeated. You probably wouldn't even have to vote for yourself. You start with 51%, didn't show up. Okay, you won. It's a process tilted in favor of incumbents. And around the world, those votes that don't get returned are counted as votes for the incumbent, for the management. Now do you see why it's so difficult to get to a 51% no vote at an annual meeting? You know who Jamie Dimon is, right? He's the czar of J.P. Morgan. Kind of an imperial monarch. And about 6 years ago, he decided he wanted to be about CEO, which is what his job is, and chairman of the board overseeing him. Get your brain wrapped around how you oversee yourself and make sure you do a fair job. And of course, some of the stockholders thought it was a bad idea, so they decided to put this to a vote at the annual meeting. And Jamie Dimon won, at least according to the Wall Street Journal, because the next day the Wall Street Journal reported that 65% of the votes were in favor of Jamie Dimon taking on the chairman position, and 35% were no. And my first reaction when I saw the 35% is pretty much everybody showed up at the meeting, voted against this. You started with what, 59? You got a few cronies to get the extra 6%. It is very difficult. It's not impossible. We talk about how sometimes the playing field can be level, but it's very difficult to get an annual meeting to be a process by which you discipline management. You see, what about those big institutional investors? The Fidelities, I was at Fidelity yesterday. You know, big building on Summer Street, all that money being moved around, or we can take BlackRock. They must throw their weight around, right? Let me show you a graph. This shows you the percentage of the time institutional investors vote with the management. This looks like a Russian election. Putin wins, 92%. My question is, who are the other 8%? Where are they running to now? Institutional investors are, for the most part, sheep. They vote with incumbent management. And in a sense, I don't blame them, because if you own shares in 250 companies, who has the time and the resources to stand and fight? There are exceptions, but most institutional investors. So if you're thinking, hey, Fidelity will stand up there and make my case for me because they own a lot of shares in this company, let go of that thought. So at the annual meeting, individuals don't show up, institutions vote with the management. It gets very difficult for annual meetings to actually get something that is not in the best interests of management. So that's why the directors the manager picks ends up being on the board of directors. And if you think it's bad in the US, you should see annual meetings the rest of the world. Annual meetings in Europe are polite, scripted affairs. People drinking tea, wine if you're in France, you know, everybody's... No. And nobody... I still remember, I think it was... which company? Lillian Betancourt, at one annual meeting, and she's, of course, L'Oreal, was asked by a stalker, Asher Edelman, an activist investor, got up and said, company owns a lot of chateaus, and who's living in those chateaus? I mean, technically, we own them. And she refused to answer. Not only did she refuse to answer the question, she said she felt ashamed for the stalker that he would even ask this question of her. Now I see why the French Revolution happened. So in Europe, forget about being impolite. You'd probably be cast aside. And in Japan, it's completely out of control. There have been, I remember in the 80s, activist investors who were trying to take positions in Japanese companies would get up to talk. And hundreds of people in the back would get up while they were talking and yell at the top of their voice. You're saying, this is so juvenile. I mean, Japanese companies used to actually hire yakuzas to show up at meetings saying, shut that guy down. If you think annual meetings don't accomplish much in the US, they probably accomplish a lot more. At least you have openings, and we'll talk about those in the US, that you don't have in the rest of the world. So annual meetings don't work that well at keeping management in line. So we trust the board of directors, right? So let's talk about the board of directors. First, take the company you own shares in, or the company you used to work in, pick up the annual report, open to the page where they have the names of the people on the board of directors. Ask yourself a very simple question. Who comes up with these names? They open up it used to be the phone book, and just randomly pick names. In most companies, you know how those names used to become. It's changing a little bit, but not by much. In most companies, and this is still true in much of the rest of the world, the CEO or top management says, I'd like that person, that person, that person. And let me offer you a choice. You become the CEO of a publicly traded company. You're deciding to put a board of directors together. And you have two choices. One is you want to create a board of very smart people who'll ask you tough questions and keep you on your toes. That's option one. Here's the second option. You walk over to your country club. If you're a CEO, you're in a country club. It's almost a given. You go to the bar area, you find the dozen most slosh people you can find, and say, would you like to be on my board? And ask yourself a question. Which one's going to make your life easier? The second one. This sounds like I'm being overwrought. You know, when John Mack became CEO of Morgan Stanley, the first two people he put on the board were two people who belonged to his country club. I don't know whether they were sloshed or not, but this can't be random. In fact, in 2015, I wrote a post about a company called Theranos. What a Theranos, right? Who hasn't? Right? It's right after that Wall Street Journal reporter asked the question of, does this blood test work? Turned out that the venture capitalist pushed up the price to $9 billion, had forgotten to ask that question. And before you dump too much on venture capitalists, neither had Walgreens nor the Cleveland Clinic. So this is a collective ignorance. And it turned out, so at that time I actually took Theranos and I said, hey, how come nobody asked the question? What was the board of directors doing? And I pulled up the board of directors for Theranos and I took one look and I said, that guy is still alive? It was George Shultz on the board, a sprightly 94. Right next to him was Henry Kissinger. What the hell is he doing on a blood testing company? Talking about the Iron Curtain, blood on that side, blood on this side. No, I don't know. And I said, and my cynical side said, if I'm a CEO and I want to create a board of directors that will never ask me a question, this is a really effective way to do it. Get 85 to 95-year-olds, put them on the board, call a board meeting, put a pillow in front of every chair, and an ambulance as backup, and you'll never be asked a question. Boards of directors in most companies essentially are handpicked by the top management. Today, I know there are search committees. But if you think those search committees are doing an independent search and not checking with the CEO and saying, what do you think about this name? You're operating in a different universe than I am. Second, in most of these companies, the directors on the board are not big stockholders. In fact, many companies, there's a minimum shareholding requirement, and companies actually give the shares to the directors and say, look, there's a 2,000-share minimum requirement, have the 2,000 shares as a gift. Why does it matter? If you're a director and you get paid $250,000 for being a director, in many big companies, that's what you typically get paid, now hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you get pensions. Do you know that if you serve as a director in some companies, you get a pension for life? And you will put that at risk by asking a tough question of management on the shareholders' back. I don't blame you for saying, you know what, this is such a cushy job. I show up once a month. I just sit there. They show slides. I can drink coffee. They have really good coffee here. Starbucks, top-notch coffee here. And 3 hours later, I walk out. I get $250,000 for doing this once a month. Come on. If you had that as a side gig, would you want to endanger that by acting upset over something and pushing management? And in many boards, you see CEOs of other companies sitting on the board. I've never understood how you can be the CEO of a company and have all this excess time on your hand. You must be a lesser version of Jack Dorsey, who not only is a CEO of one company, he's a CEO of two companies and lives in Africa. I don't know how that happens. Right? And runs both, he plans to move to Africa. You've heard about this, right? And he probably serves on five other boards. And then he shows up on Shark Tank once in a while, I would hope. My point is, you can't be the CEO of a company full-time and be on the board of directors. And the Wall Street Journal actually had an interesting article about a long time ago where they looked at boards where CEOs sat on each other's boards. So you're the CEO of a company, I'm a CEO of a company. I invite you to be on my board, and you invite me. This is a very friendly, small fraternity. We're both on each other's boards. My board meeting happens first. And I'm talking about the disaster of an investment I had in China. But I frame it as a very good investment. You know it's a disaster. You feel this urge to ask me this question of how can losing $2 billion be a good thing? But then I remember my board meeting is 2 weeks away, and I have this disaster of an investment in Nigeria that I don't want anybody to raise questions about. You know what? I'll step back. You're saying, but after Sarbanes-Oxley, this must all have changed, right? You know what Sarbanes-Oxley changed? It said you cannot have boards of directors on your board who are your brothers, your cousins, your insiders. It talked about independent directors. It didn't say independent competent directors, right? It's just independent directors. It creates this illusion of these directors don't have any direct connections to the company. Therefore, they must be independent. Therefore, they must be asking the right questions. So if you think about why boards do not challenge management more, there are a few things. The first is, Have you ever been at a meeting where somebody brings that book, The Robert's Rules of Order? This is a disaster already waiting to happen, because that book was written by the devil. Robert must be another name for the devil. You can't bring that up. This is a sequence you do things in. This is the exact opposite. If you hate disruption, this is the exact opposite end of the spectrum. It's a meeting run by Robert's Rules of Order. Because nothing can be brought up that wasn't already planned. Boards of director meetings, basically the agenda is set by the CEO, the top management. And if you try to deviate, then you know, come back to what we're talking about. The second is, even if you're an independent director, you're sitting with this board, you've been meeting with them for the last 2 or 3 years, you feel this need to be a team player. Right? Don't want to be a contrarian. It's so much easier to get along and go along. And here's the biggest challenge. It's a psychological one. 12 of you are independent directors. You are, you know, let's say the directors at Tesla. Elon Musk walks in and says, you know what? The Tesla 23 is coming out. It'll fly over the ground. It'll be a hovercraft when you need it to. It'll go over water. And part of you says, that makes no sense. Technologically, we're not there. But your reaction is, but he knows so much more about this than I do. And this is played out in pretty much every boardroom, right? The CEO does know more about the company, the business, than you do, because he spends all time with it. You're saying, so what? In psychology, there is this research that says once somebody gets tagged as an authority figure, I don't care how independent you feel nervous about asking questions, challenging that authority figure, which means that you can pass all the laws you want about how independent you want your board of directors to be, but it's not going to happen because psychology is going to get in the way. So what's the solution to this? The Catholic Church actually found a solution to this about 600 years ago. Here's the problem the Catholic Church was facing. You know how you get to sainthood in the Catholic Church, right? You show proof of miracles, and then a group in the Vatican gets together and decides whether these were miracles or just you made them up. And if they're miracles, then they were discovering that people were just becoming saints too easily. Why? Because every person who was pushed for a saint, there was a group pushing for the saint. They collected the information, the data. They came and presented the data. There weren't nobody on the other side saying, that's not a miracle. No, that can't be true. There was no, so you know what the Catholic Church created? I think it's one of the best names I've ever seen given a figure. It's the devil's advocate. What's the job of the devil's advocate? The devil's advocate's job was to collect, and he was given the resources. So if you said so-and-so is a saint, the devil's advocate was given a team, go to that country, collect information. So when you do the slide presentation in 1400, now you get the slide. This is miracle one, miracle two, miracle three, miracle four. The devil's advocate gets up with his own slides. Counter miracle one, counter miracle two, counter miracle three, counter miracle four. You see where I'm going? Maybe we should create a counter CEO. Basically, the CEO and the CEO's counter. So when the CEO gets up and says, we should do this acquisition, maybe we need an authority figure there who is given the resources. You can't just say, you have the power to just challenge. Is given the resources. So if the CEO hires a banking team to tell you how great this acquisition is, the counter CEO goes and hires another banking team, how terrible the acquisition is. You as a board still get to make the decision. Be a little chaotic, I'm sure, but a little chaos in this setting might not be a bad thing. Boards of directors are not very effective at keeping managers in line. I told you everything we do, we're going to apply. So let me take my first company and see how this plays out. It's Disney. In 1997, you know who the CEO of Disney was in 1997? A guy called Michael Eisner. A guy whose ego was so big that he could be in a large room by himself, but it felt crowded. And he was an imperial CEO, and I'm going to use that word when you have a CEO basically doesn't have to worry about the board. The board basically does whatever he or she has decided. Okay. And this was the board of directors that Michael Eisner had put together in 1997. And I think this is the worst board ever put together by a large publicly traded company in the U.S. That's quite a contest to win. Worse than the Enron board, worse than the Lehman board. This doesn't. I'll tell you what I have against this board. First, there's 17 members. You say, what's wrong with that? Here's what I would suggest. After the class today, get together as a group of 17 and decide where to go for lunch. I will predict you will not eat tonight, today. Nothing gets done. The group of 17 gets together in a meeting. You go around the table. By the time you're done, it's 3 hours are done. Who has the chance to even ask follow-up questions? So strike one, it's a big board. It's too big. In fact, studies show that the optimal size for a board is about 8 to 9 members. And once you get past that, you know, it becomes counterproductive. Second, 8 of the 17 members on this board either work for Disney or used to work for Disney. So they're insiders. So your job is to evaluate how you do as a management. You can't be an independent board. Third, the chairman of the board is Michael Eisner. And in fact, at that point in time, in 97, 80% of U.S. companies, the CEO was also the chairman of the board. Strike three, if this were baseball, you'd struck out, unless you're the Houston Astros, and you got a free strike. I'm a Yankee fan. I'm a little bitter right now, you know. But don't take it personally if you're an Astros fan. Here's the point. Let's look at the outsiders. Maybe they're so good they make up for the rest of the bad things. Let's look at a few of the outsiders. Reveta F. Bowers, principal of an elementary school in L.A. You're saying, this is good. Disney's a kid-oriented company. Here, somebody's around kids all the time. She happened to be the principal of the elementary school that Michael Eisner's kids went to. I'm sure it was pure coincidence that this happened. Let's keep going down. George Mitchell. He was checking for steroids on the board, probably. You know, ex-senator, distinguished, you know, lots of pots on the fire. And then you get to Father Leo O'Donovan. Any Georgetown alum here? Yeah? That's good. I'm sure he's a good man. It's good to have some religious authority on a heathen board like this and keep people in line so they can't do that. But again, coincidentally otherwise, Michael Eisner's son went to Georgetown. He sat on Georgetown's board, and he made some substantial donations to Georgetown. I should go to Georgetown and check to see whether there are buildings named after him. I'm not suggesting there's a quid quo pro, but it doesn't pass the smell test, right? And finally, and this is the most egregious example of self-interest being served, you have Irwin E. Russell, attorney at law. You say, what do you have against lawyers? A whole compendium, but this is not the forum to talk about that. But he happened to be Michael Eisner's personal attorney. How the heck do you get away with this? Put your lawyer on the board saying, he's going to be an independent director. He's probably saying, don't answer that question, Mike. Take the fifth on that one, Mike. It's nice to have your lawyer in the room, but don't tell me he's going to be independent and ask you tough questions. This is a horrifically bad board. It's a rubber stamp board. You know what rubber stamp boards are? They do what imperial CEOs tell them to do. And this explains some of the really crazy things that happened at Disney in the 90s. In fact, I'm going to suggest a book for you to read in your spare time, which you don't have. It's a book by James Stewart called Disney War. I'll send you the link. And if you don't have the money, I might have a copy. I can lend it to you. It's about what happened at Disney. And to give you some perspective, Michael Eisner came to Disney in 1986 when Disney had hit the skids. They hadn't had a hit movie. They were still living off the oxygen, if there was any left over, from Walt Disney, who died in the late 60s, the company. So by 86, the company had pretty much hit the skids. They hadn't had a hit in 15 years. Paramount then was a successful movie company. So Michael Eisner comes over from Paramount. And he extracts a bargain in addition to compensation package. He says, I'd like to bring my personal assistant with me. You're saying, what's the big deal? In the days before smartphones, personal assistants essentially ran your life for you. They told you where you lived, who your wife was, when her birthday was. Essentially, your personal assistant, you know, was, think of it as your iPhone in a person. A guy called Andrew Katzenberg. And Katzenberg did not want to leave Paramount. He said, this is a winning company. Why do I want to go to that loser company? So in return for, I'm sorry, Jeff Katzenberg. So in return for Katzenberg coming over, Disney, you know, Michael Eisner made him an offer. He said, I'll let you head a division. That's a big jump up from PA, right? You can be a division head. And given how Michael Eisner thought, he decided to give him the loser division. The animated movie division. Now, Disney hasn't had an animated movie hit in 15 years. You run that division, and he felt so confident that this division was going to crash and burn. He said, oh, I'll give you 5% of all the profits you make on any new animated movies you can come up with. So Katzenberg comes in, becomes the head of the animated movie division, and the rest, as they say, is cultural history. You got Little Mermaid, Lion King. Can you imagine living, getting 5% of the profits every time the sea witch opens her mouth? You have no idea who the sea witch is. You should catch up on movies, right? And Katzenberg turned the animated movie division around and made it the most successful part of Disney. By 91, it was accounting for a third of the profits, the most successful part. Now, in any business textbook, you hire a guy to run a losing division. He turns a division around, makes it a success. What happens in the business book? He's given more power and moved up the ranks. That thought never even crossed Eisner's mind. He said, I've got to get rid of this guy. Why? Because he's becoming a threat. I use the word imperial CEO. Think about thrones and kings on the throne and people as a threat. So he went to the board of directors and said, we've got to get rid of Katzenberg. Now, if you're a sensible director, what's your first question? But he's running the most successful division. Why? You know what Eisner's answer was? Because I don't like him. So one of the directors brings up the fact that this unpleasant fact that you're, you know, 5% of the profits in perpetuity you promised him from the movies. You know what Eisner said? Don't pay him. Why? I don't like him. And of course, Katzenberg sued, as he was entitled to. So Eisner gets, so the court said, the judge asked, you know, Mr. Eisner, what's your basis for refusing to pay Mr. Katzenberg? And he said, I don't like him. Judge looks through the code and says, you know what, I don't see that as a justifiable reason. And he awards Katzenberg $150 million that Disney stockholders to pay out. And if that were the end of the story, it'd still be a sad story. Now it becomes a tragedy. Katzenberg, of course, decides to start his own company, DreamWorks. And he brings this undying hatred of all things Disney to it. If you ever watch the Shrek movies, notice how they get this digs into Disney characters. Sleeping Beauty had an addiction problem. That's why she was sleeping, you know. Snow White hung out with 7 perverts. And, you know, basically, you know, and you wonder, what's going on here? Hey, there's a history here between Katzenberg and Eisner that's playing out in the Shrek movies. So two movie suggestions. Watch The Little Mermaid followed by, you know, Shrek. And you kind of get the picture. And the board went along. Okay. You'd think he'd learn, right? 2 years later, Disney hires this guy called Michael Ovitz. Michael Ovitz was the biggest agent in Hollywood. He worked for, you know, so basically, you know, he was a great agent. Never ran a business. This is like hiring Scott Boras to run the Yankees. Your players will all be well paid, but you will never win a title from this day on because you're probably going to go bankrupt next year. But they hire Michael Ovitz, and he comes in, and turns out the day after he hires, Eisner already has second thoughts. So they consign him to the side. And finally, they get rid of him as well without giving a good reason again. And they have to pay him another $100 million. This sounds like a good thing. Go work for Disney, make Eisner hate you, get fired, collect $100 million, move on. And I remember reading a Wall Street Journal article saying, why would the board of directors at Disney go along with this? And I said, have you looked at who's on the board? Sometimes when you see people saying, why would the board, just take a look at the board and the answer is right there. And Disney did win some contests. In 1997, CalPERS, which is a California Public Employee Fund, one of the largest institutional investors, and at that time one of the few activist funds, which is actually, they used to pick the 10 worst companies and challenge the management, listed out the worst boards, and they had 3 tests that they used, and they said there's a majority of the directors, outsiders, chairman of the board, independent of the company, the compensation and audit committees, you know, separated, and Disney was the only company to fail all 3. In fact, I forgot to mention one of the names here, you know, that I skipped over was Sidney Poitier. Great actor. Right? But he was on the list of top 10 directors in 97, directors who missed the most meetings. So guess who's coming to dinners? Guess who's not coming to the meeting this time? And he was the head of the compensation committee. Disney failed all three tests, was the only company to fail all three tests. Let me pile on. In Business Week in 97, ranked the company's worst director. Guess who's on top? Disney. And close behind them, saying, we can't lose this contest, was AT&T.